Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. On Friday, Governor Gavin Newsom signed SB 855, a mental health parity bill, which will require health insurance companies to cover medically necessary mental health and substance use disorder treatments. The bill was also designed to address mental health conditions that affect people living on the streets. It was introduced by California State Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco, a Democrat. He joins us now to help us understand how the new law will work and why it's needed. And Senator, nice to speak with you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So how does this legislation set California apart from the rest of the country?
Well, SB 855 puts California in the lead in terms of ensuring people can access mental health and addiction treatment, not having to wait until they're in crisis and going to the hospital, but early on, while they still have a job, while they still have a home, while they still have their family, to try to nip it in the bud and get them healthy. And we're very grateful that the governor signed the bill. What the legislation does is pretty simple. We have this concept called mental health parity, where we say the truth, which is that mental health is no different than physical health. And we've had this, I think, really dysfunctional approach in our country for a long time, that mental health really, it's somehow not physically based and it doesn't deserve the same level of treatment. And so we have allowed insurance companies for many years to say, we're not going to cover your mental health or addiction treatment. We know you have a problem. We're not going to cover it until you're in deep crisis. And even then, we're only going to cover it for a short period of time just to get you triaged and stable again. We would never tolerate that for physical health. If you go in with stage one cancer, you get treatment now. You don't have to wait until you're at stage four cancer. And so SB 855 guarantees that you will get your insurance to cover early mental health and addiction care if a doctor thinks it's necessary. That does put California on the forefront.
Hmm. Does it cover any sort of treatments that might be in place? You know, on the physical side of things, when you go in for a checkup and, you know, different preventative measures is the word I was looking for. when you have the hospital will take you in and that gets covered. Are there preventative measures in parity measures in this?
Yeah, so if the rule is if your doctor says that X treatment for a mental health or addiction issue is medically necessary, that's the key term, medically necessary under prevailing medical standards, then the insurance company must cover it. Yes, it is designed for early intervention. If someone is manifesting the first signs of a mental health issue, or let's say that they have just started to use meth, but they're not having issues yet, but they feel like they're becoming addicted, the doctor can intervene and say, you need this treatment, let's nip it in the bud. Because we know with mental health and addiction, the earlier you can intervene with treatment, the more likely you are of success. If someone has already had a break, if they've already unraveled, it is much, much harder to get them back into stability.
Mm. Does this bill, Senator, affect those who are using Medi-Cal as their insurance provider?
It does not, because Medi-Cal is a good actor here. Medi-Cal actually already covers these early interventions. So there was no need for us to include Medi-Cal. We are directing the private insurance industry to act like Medi-Cal is already acting.
We know that mental health and homelessness can often go hand in hand. How does the legislation work in that realm?
Well, this is actually a homelessness prevention measure, because a certain portion of our homeless population becomes homeless because of mental health or addiction. They had a home, they had a job, and because of untreated mental health or addiction issues, they unravel and they lose all that and they become homeless. So this will help prevent people from becoming homeless. For people who are homeless, Some have health coverage because there are homeless people who are employed, but many do not. And so we want to get that homeless population onto Medi-Cal. We want to get them the public health help that they need. One other thing I just want to mention, because we did some legislation around this a few years ago, but it is so important, is the critical importance of getting mental health treatment to young people, to middle school, high school, college age kids. We know that half of all mental health issues manifest by the age of 14 and 75% by the age of 24. And so we are failing young people by not getting early, quick interventions so that they can get stabilized.
California State Senator Scott Wiener, you are based in San Francisco, which has an extreme homelessness crisis and has for many years. Is that sort of the impetus for you working on this?
Well, mental health and addiction are clearly a real challenge in San Francisco, but it's a challenge everywhere. And even though the street homelessness that we see, when you see homeless people on the street, you're seeing a tiny percentage of the homeless population. And so sometimes people see people who are living in a tent on a sidewalk or who are really having severe mental health issues. And you assume that all homeless people are that way. We know most homeless people do not have mental health or addiction problems, but we do have a subset on our streets who have severe problems. Last year, I authored and Governor Newsom signed legislation to create a new kind of conservatorship that San Francisco and a few other counties can use to help the most severely debilitated people. But that's just one piece of it. We have a lot more work to do, but we also need to be clear that overwhelmingly, people with mental health and addiction challenges are not homeless. It is something that is throughout our society. COVID-19 is making it worse, and we have really denied people access to treatment, even if they have good insurance. And that's what SB 855 is designed to get at, for the people who do have insurance, making sure they can access treatment and not spiral out of control.
All right. California State Senator Scott Wiener, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
And now let's turn to Governor Gavin Newsom's senior counselor for housing and homelessness, Jason Elliott. And Jason, at the beginning of the year, the governor made homelessness a key issue that he wanted to address this year. This is how he put it during part of the speech.
Let's call it what it is. It's a disgrace that the richest state in the richest nation succeeding across so many sectors is falling so far behind to properly house, heal, and humanely treat so many of its own people.
And that was, of course, before we understood the full ramifications of the coming pandemic. A big chunk of his speech addressed the need to find solutions to homelessness and mentioned mental health and substance abuse as areas of needed focus. He told counties to spend their mental health dollars by the end of June or the state would do it for them. So how did all of that play out, Jason? Was the money used for mental health services or was that deadline shifted because of the pandemic?
Good morning and thanks for having me this morning and thanks for spending the time to focus on this important topic. You're absolutely right. I think when the governor gave that State of the State speech on February 19th, my goodness, how the world has changed since then. And there are a whole number of initiatives that the governor proposed in that speech, some of which have come to pass, albeit under different circumstances, and are now implemented in helping people. And some, of course, have been put off because all of us had plans that we laid at the beginning of the year, personally and professionally, that have been derailed by this pandemic. So to your specific question, Randall, that statement the governor made was around counties spending their Mental Health Services Act funds, and they were supposed to do that by June 30th of this year. We've added an additional 12 months for counties to be able to spend that money down. So certainly some counties have spent a lion's share of those reserves, but because of the uncertainty that we've all faced this year, we've provided local governments with an additional year to spend that money down.
Is the acronym for that act HEAP?
Sorry, that's MHSA. HEAP is a different program because we in government love our acronyms.
Right.
HEAP is a program that has since been built on several times, whereby the state provides local governments with significant sources of funding to address homelessness in their communities. And it's an important point to make. In California, homeless services and behavioral health services are administered at the county level. So the state funds those. The state sets policy parameters for that funding. But at the end of the day, it is your local government, in most cases, counties, in some cases, cities, that actually build the homeless housing, serve the homeless individuals, and administer those services.
We'll be speaking with a professor about HEAP coming up, and I just wanted to make Great. Sure that we weren't talking about the same thing.
Different four-letter acronym.
Right. let's talk about Project Home Key, which was Great. Called, if I understand this, it was called Project Room Key. Was it just a name change, or are there some significant differences that you can explain?
It's a great question. They're different programs. So Project Room Key came first. And Project Room Key was an initiative that we stood up in simply a matter of weeks. It got up and running at the beginning of April. And if you'll recall, the pandemic really took hold in the middle of March. So in those several weeks, the state came together with a number of researchers and other experts and put together Project Room Key. And Project Room Key, just a moment on sort of what it is and what it was. It was our way of responding to what at the time was a deep, deep fear about how the coronavirus could spread among homeless people. Obviously, what we know now about how the virus spreads and is transmitted and manifests is much more advanced than what we understood in March. And at the time, we did some modeling with some public health experts outside of the state government. And we were looking at potentially 50,000 homeless people becoming infected with the coronavirus. Mm. Based on the attack rate we were modeling at the time. That's just downright paralyzing and frightening. So we worked very quickly, hand in hand with FEMA at the federal government, to stand up Project Room Key. And the idea of Project Room Key, which now has 16,487 rooms in Project Room Key, we've served over 22,300 homeless individuals since the pandemic started, is that homeless individuals don't have a place to shelter at home, to quarantine at home, or to isolate for obvious reasons. But in order to protect public health, not only of people experiencing homelessness, but California more broadly, we need to provide that what we call in sort of wonky terms, non-congregate sheltering opportunities, which is just basically isolation and quarantine. So we thought very quickly and very hard about the best way to do that, and how we landed was on leasing hotels and motels around the state and providing those opportunities to homeless individuals so they can protect not only themselves, but their communities. So that's Project
Room. Many certainly weren't being used because of the pandemic. So it sort of everything sort of lined up perfectly for that.
Absolutely right. And a good point. So that's Project Room Key. And Project Room Key is still going. And at that number that I cited, that is last night, or actually I should say on Friday night, we get stats every weekday. There were 15,272 people. That was as of Friday, right? This is a program that is still very much up and running and serving people in every community. I think we're in 53 or 54 counties around the state. You know, I'll just give an example for your listeners. In Sacramento County, for example, there are 529 hotel rooms and 63 travel trailers. You know, in Placer County, for example, there are 83 hotel rooms and 12 travel trailers that are serving homeless individuals. That's as of this weekend, right? So that's Project Room Key, and that still continues to move. Home Key is an outshoot of Project Room Key. It doesn't replace it. Project Room Key are leased hotels where we put people in order to protect themselves and the community. Home Key is different. Home Key, we're actually buying, we're working with the communities, with local communities, to buy facilities, to buy motels, to buy vacant apartment buildings, to buy tiny home duplexes, and create some permanence in ownership and permanence in those housing opportunities. Because while Room Key really is a sort of medical response, it's quickly, quickly get people off the streets, quickly, quickly get people out of shelter. Home Key really is about the fact that we know that under a housing first model, permanent supportive housing and other kinds of stable housing, that's really the way to solve homelessness. And that's what Home Key is.
Jason, so I'm sorry, we only have about a minute and a half left,
I
want to make sure I get to some of this. So how do these hotels under Project Home Key qualify? Mm-hmm. Are there rules regarding like the hotel's location to surrounding neighborhoods, grocery stores, public transit, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely right. So we look to locate these hotels. First of all, the counties and the local governments are the ones that identify them, and then they bring those forward, and then the state chooses to fund those. We've so far funded over 2,500 units just in the last few weeks, over $300 million for purchases. And we're going to continue to make announcements about those. The governor will be sharing some news later today. But the counties identify those and they bring those forward and we fund them. And we have, in addition to having an access to services metric, like near grocery stores, near laundromats, we also want to make sure that we're focusing on racial equity, because we know that homelessness disproportionately impacts communities, especially the African-American community in California. So we're wanting to make sure that we're being very sensitive to those inequities as well and responding to that. So at all said and done, we're planning on spending north of $600 million to buy thousands and thousands of units. And final point, Randall, usually homeless housing costs $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 per unit to create, and it takes several years. So far under Home Key, we're coming in at about $130,000 per unit, and these units will all be occupiable in the next few months. So much more cost effective and much quicker than traditional permanent supportive housing, which plays an important role in the continuum. But this is just another tool to help homeless individuals exit homelessness in California.
And more news to come from the governor today on Project Home Key. Jason Elliott is senior counselor to Governor Newsom. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Up next, we'll look at a $500 million state program and hear from a researcher who has studied how well it's going. Also, a discussion about why LGBTQ minors are often homeless at much higher rates than the general population. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And our big conversation today is on homelessness. Now, a couple of years ago, the California State Legislature passed SB 850. That was a housing bill that in part required the Department of Housing and Community Development to allocate $500 million toward assisting those who are experiencing homelessness. Over the past year, Sac State researchers have worked on an initial study regarding the Homeless Emergency Aid Program, or HEAP, that you heard me mention earlier in the program. Here to give us an overview of the findings is Arturo Bialki, Associate Professor of Social Work at Sacramento State. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, let's start with the research that you did. Is it working? Is the HEAP program doing what it set out intended to do?
Yeah, that's the $500 million question.
Right.
In some ways, it is. I mean, it's really early. The assessment that we did was really just last year, looking at how communities were strategizing in terms of how they're using these funds. But we also talked to folks and asked about, you know, how many folks they were housing and how many people they were helping. And there's evidence that, you know, many thousands of people were helped by this infusion of state funds that the state provided communities.
Were you able at all to look into the why, like why California has such a large homeless population?
Yes. So part of our report kind of provides a context of HEAP. You may know this, but California has the largest homeless population. About one in four people experiencing homelessness in the country are in California.
So even more so than the state's population compared to the rest of the country, it's the rate's even higher than that.
That's right. I mean, we have a large state, obviously, 38 million people, 300 million people in the country. But we represent twice that amount, 25% of people experiencing homelessness. And unfortunately, during the last 4 years, there's been a pretty dramatic increase. Almost every single community has reported double-digit increases in the last 4 years. And part of, there's many different reasons, and researchers debate on the one main reason, but most researchers agree that housing and the lack of affordable housing is driving this. And so the last 4 years, for instance, there was pretty dramatic increases in rents. And we see that in markets that had dramatic increases in rents, we saw dramatic increases in homelessness.
So during the, during much of the Obama administration, certainly the final 6 years of that, and then through the Trump administration, the economy has been improving until we hit the pandemic. Why was the population, the homeless population, also increasing during that period when the economy was doing so well?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the paradoxes here, because, you know, between 2007 and 2017, there was almost 120 consecutive months of growth. And the economy in California was recovering pretty well from the 2008 recession. Unemployment was going down from 9% to 3.9%, something like that. Yet the homeless population was actually decreasing for a while. And then 2015, all of those successes, all of the impacts that we had made reversed themselves. And part of what we do in the report is discuss some of these contextual factors. What we saw is also an increase in the level of inequality. So while this is a very wealthy state, there is pretty dramatic disparities between people below the 30th percentile in terms of income and those on the 70th percentile, for example. And some indications suggest that inequality is now worse here in California than it's been in 50 years. And inequality kind of parallels itself in the housing market. So you know, you hear a lot that we have a housing crisis. That's true primarily for people who make under, you know, $50,000, but we actually have a surplus of housing for people who make much more than that. So inequality really does kind of play itself out in terms of how much people can afford. There's an affordability crisis, in short.
Help us dig down a little into the types of programs and the goals of those programs under HEAP.
Sure. So HEAP was kind of a set of block grants given to what are called continuums of care, essentially a consortium of providers that work at the county level to provide homeless services. And this was an infusion of funds that were very flexible. They were block grants. And so communities were allowed to decide how they wanted to use those funds. The big buckets of programs or spending was on direct services. So hiring outreach workers, hiring folks to help people navigate the homeless system. Another big bucket was capital investments. So building new shelters or building new permanent supportive housing. And then the last big bucket was rental subsidies. So folks that might be struggling with their rent, there were flexible funds created to allow people to stay in their apartments for a while as they worked on issues.
Are there recommendations that are being made or were made in order to help guide any future funding or implementation decisions?
Well, I think one of the great things we saw in HEAP is that there's a lot of new regional coordination. Homelessness is something that we think about in terms of our own community, but if you look across the state, most communities are experiencing the same thing. And so I think HEAP is kind of encouraging coordination across communities, not just, you know, what's going on in my town. And so I think one of the recommendations that we have from the report is that this needs to keep on happening. And we see the state being much more invested in helping with the coordination of these programs across counties. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of new innovative programs that we saw come out of HEAP. And of course, this is all pre-COVID. And so things have changed dramatically. But, you know, communities can use some of their HEAP funds for COVID-related issues as well. Our report's a little bit dated, obviously, because it came out right when the pandemic started.
Mm-hmm. So then that leads me to, what are you studying next? I imagine it'll be pandemic-related.
Yeah, so we're going to continue working with the state to do kind of a second evaluation of HEAP, kind of how things have changed, how communities pivoted. I work at a center here at Sac State that we do various program research projects on homelessness. So we're also doing a project on policing and homelessness. And also looking at how Californians perceive the issue of homelessness. You know, your one of your guests was talking about the conflation that people make between mental health and homelessness.
Right.
And mental health is a really important component of the of homeless situations, but it's not the one that defines all homelessness. It's actually a minority of people who have severe mental illness. So we're looking at how Californians think about mental health and sometimes conflate homelessness together.
And how long does the process take for that type of study?
We have some white papers that we produce. You know, publication takes a while to happen at the academic level. So we're actually releasing a lot of these in white papers that we're making available on our website. So some of these findings we're actually publishing right now.
Oh, excellent. Arturo Bielke, Associate Professor of Social Work at Sacramento State, thank you for your insight today into programs and how they're working.
Great. Thank you.
Appreciate that. As some of the youngest people on the streets identify as LGBTQ, while the numbers aren't always accurate, research does suggest that anywhere between 20 to 40% of homeless minors identify in that category. Here to shed some light on that topic is the CEO of the Sacramento LGBT Community Center, David Heitzman. Nice to have you here.
Randall, thank you for having me.
So the center is conducting its own census this year. We're in a census year, so but specifically, you want to get data on the number of LGBTQ community members in the area. Does that census also include outreach to those in the homeless community?
Sure, it absolutely does. I mean, we in our own community have a lot of people who are experiencing homelessness, youth in particular, at a much disproportionate rate at 40% of the homeless youth population. Mm-hmm. And so we are doing outreach both within our programs, within our partner organizations, and in the community.
How would you say that LGBTQ youth are disproportionately impacted by homelessness?
Well, homelessness is obviously a complex problem, and it is at the individual level too, where there are intersections of race and gender and sexual orientation and economic security, all of which the LGBTQ community and those different subpopulations experience disparities compared to the general population. Mm-hmm. And so that just creates sort of layers and layers of challenge for individuals that ultimately end up becoming homeless and struggle to regain some economic security and stability in their lives.
How do you count homelessness? It's not necessarily someone on the street. It can be someone what I guess we would call couch surfing, right?
Sure. You know, youth are often trying to hide in plain sight. They are couch surfing. They're double or tripled up. They're living in a garage or staying temporarily with an extended family member or friend, but are constantly kind of moving. There are folks who are living on the river, living along the railroad tracks and living outside, and there are quite a few of them in Sacramento, obviously. And homelessness can just look different, especially for youth.
David, what leads to this? I imagine we can assume there are situations where the parents are or the guardians are not happy with the LGBTQ identification of the child, and say, not in my home. Is that the driving force, or are there other things at play here?
Yeah, I mean, most often we see that LGBTQ youth who are experiencing homelessness are homeless as a result of being rejected by family and by just the general societal rejection that they experience. There's a common misperception that the community has really gained a lot of acceptance because we have legal rights now and there is a lot more representation in popular culture, but we still see a hugely disproportionate number of youth who are being bullied and harassed or kicked out of their homes and are suffering from unemployment and other insecurities that lead them into homelessness.
The Sacramento LGBT Community Center has programs to help address this, right? And some act somewhat as like a foster program?
So we did start three new housing programs over the last 3 years, a 12-bed shelter, a 6-bed transitional living home, and the host home program that you just mentioned. We're working up to 20 host homes as a sort of a lower cost and really community-driven initiative where individuals in the community who have an extra bedroom can open their homes to a youth experiencing homelessness and be able to host them for 4 to 6 months where they kind of get stable, have some stabilization. Maybe they're between jobs or maybe they're between school and their tuition check financial aid check coming in. And so we can provide that bridge for them into housing stability using a host home that's really community based.
Mm-hmm. David, when we use the term youth, what are we talking about? The age range here.
So the youth who are minors can and are homeless, especially folks who have maybe tried to leave the foster care system. But we are talking for these programs about a transitional age youth, so 18 to 24 year old youth. And so all of our housing programs are open to transitional age youth. And that's really where we focus our attention on those who are not really eligible for other resources or have perhaps aged out of the foster system, are no longer dependents of their parents legally, and really have nowhere else to go.
So technically adults, but still, you know, very young and vulnerable.
Absolutely. Yes. Still very young and vulnerable. Often they didn't have the support of parents and family when they were growing up. So sort of some of the fundamental things that you might learn as an adolescent from your parents and your community, a supportive community system, they haven't achieved those skills. And so these programs are really designed not only to provide the wraparound services for mental health and housing and clothing and food and the basic needs, but to help create self-reliance and build life skills that will allow them to live on their own.
Some of the other skills that they might get during those formative years would come from school. And I'm wondering, how do homeless children continue to go to school, but not have a place to shelter?
Yeah, youth are particularly creative at doing this, right? There are a lot of young people who are living in their cars or sort of living at the library at the community college or at a university and taking showers at the rec center and finding ways to sort of hide in plain sight, like I mentioned earlier, and just to continue their education and be able to survive, but are experiencing homelessness and are really challenged in so many different ways than other students are.
Are you hearing stories of this being more difficult to do with the pandemic? You know, not every place is open for this sort of hiding in plain sight. And with classes being online, you know, you need to have a computer and you need to have access to Wi-Fi.
That's absolutely right. It is increasingly challenging for them. They don't have a place to charge their phone. They don't have a place to get out of the heat. And so we have opened our facility for our respite programs where youth can come in and access those resources. They can use Wi-Fi at the center. They have access to food and beverage and showers and laundry facilities. And then we can get them into a program. But it is really difficult when everything is closed and your only options are to live outside.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the hosting program that you have, are you getting plenty of people volunteering for that or is it tough?
So that's one of the biggest challenges during the pandemic is that the host home program is really designed to be community based. And so that requires family members or families, not family members of the youth, but family in the community to open their homes with an extra room. And people were pretty scared about that during the pandemic and bringing someone in from outside. I mean, I will say that we provide a lot of support both for the hosts and for the youth in terms of case management, testing. Before they come into the programs, there's been a formal intake program for them to come into the program, so it's as safe as we possibly can make it. But the real challenge with this is we're in a pilot project with the host home program now. So even though we know that it's it costs about half as much to put someone in a host home as it does to put them in a shelter bed, and it's really community based. So there's that community based support of a host home that we hope to really capitalize on. It is in the pilot program. It comes from the HEAP funding that you were talking about earlier with one of your other guests, provided by the city. And so we're actually currently awaiting to word about whether or not the city will continue to fund that project into next year and beyond.
All right. David Heitzman is CEO of the Sacramento LGBT Community Center. David, it's great to see you again, and I appreciate you coming on the show and shedding some light on this for us.
Thank you very much, Randall.
Still ahead, we'll hear the firsthand account of a man who successfully transitioned out of homelessness, but who also says his opportunities may not work for those on the streets today and why. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and today's big conversation that we've been attempting to tackle is the issue of homelessness. And we know that the pandemic has complicated many things, and we just thought now might be a good time to get a status check on where the state stands, some of the different programs that are going on, and our own communities. You know, just north of downtown Sacramento, you'll often see lines of people waiting for a meal or any other type of assistance that they can get from a nonprofit in the area called Loaves and Fishes. Joseph Smith was one of the many who sought food, shelter, and aid there during his effort to get out of homelessness. He's come a long way since then. He's now the advocacy director for Loaves and Fishes, and he joins us to share his success story and provide some insight into how others might be able to follow a similar path, though he does say the opportunities he had don't necessarily exist as they did for him. Joseph, great to have you here. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we spoke on Friday in just sort of an informal you know, get to know each other sort of thing. And I was really inspired by your story. And I thought we were doing a show on homelessness today. And I thought, let's get Joseph on to share his story. So, you know, firsthand how somebody can slide into homelessness. And you've also learned how to pull yourself out of that difficult situation. I also imagine, Joseph, that during your time on the streets, you've heard many stories of how people ended up there, and you probably continue to hear those stories in your current role. Can you paint that picture for us of how easily somebody can go from having shelter to being without a place to call home?
You know, it can be as simple as losing a job. It could be as simple as a relationship, two people parting ways, and one or both not being able to afford to stand up on their own and live on their own. Mm-hmm. Mental illness is something that plagues our community and our society. And if you're suffering with mental illness, you're not necessarily making good decisions on your own behalf, financially or otherwise. I mean, there are a number of reasons. I met a man who he never understood how to save or plan for his future. He was a truck driver, commercial truck driver, and he ended up with diabetes, and they took away his commercial driving license. Mm-hmm. Then he couldn't pay his mortgage. And 6 months later, you know, I was sitting down with him to explain to him how to get a meal here at Loaves and Fishes. I mean, it can happen just like that.
A domino effect where one thing goes wrong, in this case, the man's health, not his mental health, just his own health, which then affected his ability to do his main source of income, and it just continued from there. And I imagine you see this playing out over and over.
Over and over, and it's like quicksand, Randall. You know, once a person steps into quicksand, you know, the struggle begins to get out, and the harder you struggle, the deeper, you know, mm-hmm. you go down.
When you first felt your toe dipping into that quicksand, what was going through your mind? What were you thinking? Like, how am I all of a sudden in this position that I've seen others in?
Well, when things went awry for me, it was 2005. And all my life I had suffered with anxiety and depression, and life got to be a little too overwhelming for me, and I didn't know or didn't understand where to go or how to get help. I just walked away. And I hear that often too, mm-hmm. that people just don't know what to do. The pressure on life is too great, and they just walk away. And I walked away, and never in a million years, as I, you know, thought at the time, that this was something that I could have gotten back out of. But like I said, once you dip your toe in quicksand, you're going to start, you know, getting pulled down.
Yeah, and I think 2020 has certainly been a year like that for people, where they may hear you saying that right now and say, "Oh, wow, I'm right on the edge of that." If you could do it over differently, I imagine you wouldn't have just walked away. But when you found yourself in that situation, how long did it last? How long were you without shelter?
So that was mid-2005, and my last day living unhoused was April Fool's Day of 2011. So April Fool's.
Yeah.
So about 5.5 years of, and these were pretty rough years. There was a lot going on at that time. The weather in Sacramento was horrendous. It was like one of the wetter times we've had in a really long time. And it was tough years, and there wasn't, again, I didn't know where to go or what to do to turn for help for a long time. You know, I was actually introduced to loaves and fishes probably a few years into my time on the street. I spent most of my time in the Rancho Cordova, College Greens area of town. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until like I ran into the right person who said, "Hey, you know, you can come down to Loaves and Fishes and they've got some things to help you get by."
And was that the first opportunity? You mentioned opportunities that perfectly laid themselves out for you in order for you to achieve shelter. Was that the first in that string of opportunities?
It was setting the table for a later date. Mm. You know, it wasn't the thing that that changed the path at that moment, but it certainly, as you can see, I'm working for Loaves and Fishes now. It certainly set the table for what was to come later. What the agency that helped me get off the streets was the Volunteers of America. They have a facility on North Fifth Street. Or used to have a facility on North 5th Street called the Comprehensive Alcohol Treatment Center, the CATC. That was where I landed. I'd landed there a few times, but I landed there on April Fool's Day of 2011. Mm-hmm. And that program, even though that facility still exists, that program, and there's a different operator in there now, doesn't exist in the same form that it did then. It's different today.
So what would you say could be a key for somebody today to get out of their current situation? We've had several guests on today talking about the governor's Project Room Key and Project Home Key programs. We've also heard about some of the different HEAP funding and other funding. What do you think works best to get someone out of their situation?
The moment they say, "I'm ready," mm-hmm. "I'm ready," you know, "I'm ready to get help. I'm ready to quit drinking. I'm ready to quit. I'm ready to stop staying outside. I'm done. I've had it." Right now, there's really no mechanism that just grabs that person in that moment. That is such a, it's a beautiful moment, but it's a critical moment. Mm. And there's nothing there right now that grabs you at that moment and says, "Okay, I'm going to help you. And if it doesn't work out, that's okay. We'll try again later when you're ready." And that was what the VOA was for me. You know, when I landed there that time, it was time. And that's what I said. And that's what they did.
You were motivated and they were motivated to help you.
Yeah, and that's, you know, being a provider in a shelter or a system of care for people experiencing homelessness can be really tough, you know, on the provider, the people that are actually doing the work. And so when someone steps up and says, "Hey, I'm ready," you're like, "Yes, I'm ready too," and and away you can go. You can start a journey that may work out, may not, but that's the moment. That's the sweet spot.
And you got to seize it.
You got to seize it while it's there, because you never know when you're going to have that moment again with that person. And right now, the way the system is wired, the way the system works, is there's really no catch. There's no place that, like, if someone come and knocked on my door right now and said, I'm done, I've had it, I'm like, well, we can call these people and get you on a wait list. What is that? You know, that's just an opportunity to walk back out onto the street and any number of things to happen.
Joseph, what would you say is the biggest misconception regarding homeless people by people who have shelter? The many people that you passed on the street who might give you a side glance or something like that. What do you think people need to understand that they don't currently?
Think they currently don't, you know, maybe living under the misconception that most people want to be homeless. That's absurd. Most people do not want to be homeless. They do not want to be living outside. They don't want to be living on a tent by the river. They don't want every moment of their waking existence to be in survival mode. After a while, they get acclimated to it. And I think people start to see them as, well, that's the way they want it. You know, they're building out these little encampments with all this stuff, and they must want to be there because mm-hmm. of that. No one, not many people, I can say, really want to be in that situation at all. And, you know, some would say that people will talk about, well, they don't want any help. They just don't want any help. We can't help someone who doesn't want any help. And that's a misconception also. They may be underneath of kind of that grizzled exterior from being outside for so long. They may be pretty untrusting, pretty standoffish with people. The fact of the matter is the right person comes along and at the right time and offers help, they're going to take it and they're going to do their best with it.
Mm-hmm. Do you support people handing out cash on the streets? You know, if somebody's asking for money, or are there better avenues of support for people who do not have shelter?
You know, I think one of the things that is, I've always taken a stance that's really none of my business is the way people want to give. You know, everybody wants to give differently. What I do encourage so much is the willingness to give, you know. Maybe it's not the best option. Maybe it's not the best option to stick this particular person in a congregate shelter for help. I mean, there are a lot of things that it's very specific to the person, and I would never want to say that a person's way of giving might not be the best way to go. I just want them to continue to give and to continue to keep their heart open. And if keeping their heart open means they hand somebody a couple of dollars on the street, then so be it.
Joseph, I'm not sure how much of the show you were able to hear today, but we had several guests on Insight, including the governor's office, a state lawmaker, a researcher, an mm-hmm. advocate, all talking about ways to fix the problem of so many Californians facing homelessness. You are on the front lines. You've been part of that community. What did you hear today that gives you hope?
Well, you know, Project Home Key is the natural progression of Project Room Key, and the strong desire to get folks from those temporary hotel placements into a more permanent arrangement is vital, is absolutely vital. You cannot have housed these folks for months. And if you put them back on the street right now, it is going to be an absolute disaster for them. It will be devastating to these folks. Living outside unhoused is so such a hopeless experience. Mm-hmm. To have a little bit of hope, to have a little bit of comfort, to have a little bit of security of a roof over your head, and then have that pulled out from underneath of you, may be the final straw for some of these folks. And so I'm really glad to hear that so many areas of our state have been able to begin the process of securing these more permanent motel arrangements.
Yeah.
Sacramento's has two in mind, one in the South area and one over here in the River District. And that's tough because they're already opposing the one in the River District. Mm. You know, you'll see it in the newspaper. We don't want this here anymore. We don't want anyone housed in our district. We've done enough already. And
so you're hoping that we can overcome that and continue providing more shelter. Joseph yeah. Smith, Advocacy Director at Loaves and Fishes, thank you so much for sharing such personal information with us today. We very much appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Tomorrow, we're talking about the presidential debate with none other than political junkie Ken Rudin. We're wondering how you're planning to watch it, because it's such a different year. Email us, insight@capradio.org. And that is Insight for today. I'm Randall White. We'll catch you right back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.